Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. It's an interesting political time, and I'm so excited to have co-host Dan McKay on the right. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, everybody.
And sitting in for Shireen Gourbani, who's on the blackout because of her election, we have Emily Hayes, the Salt Lake County Democratic Party chair. Welcome, Emily. You've been a frequent guest on the show, and we're glad to have you back now for, we're going to have you for 4 weeks.
Hey, glad to be here.
Dan, let's just explain to our listeners why Shireen doesn't come. The public radio station does not want to advantage her in her race, and so they actually have a period where she cannot be on the program. You've had this blackout before, Dan.
I thought it was because like she was too liberal even for public radio, and as a result, we had to banish her. So you're telling me it's an election thing? I'm just kidding. No, yeah,
it's an election thing.
I mean, we try to do that. It's one of the crazy things about being a candidate and being on radio at the same time. There are rules that require fairness and that kind of thing. And so instead of trying to wrestle with, you know, allowing everybody's opponent to sit in the studio with us every week, this is a better way to handle it. And we'll miss Shireen. She is going to be more competently covered by Emily. So, it'll be a great show.
Yeah. Emily, let's begin with you. All eyes are on Salt Lake City. We are taping this on Wednesday morning before the debate Wednesday night. Listeners will hear this on Thursday. But there could be upwards of 100 million people watching the debate tonight on the University of Utah campus. We'll have the candidates behind plexiglass. I'd just love to hear your color commentary on what this means to the city.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting to have Senator Harris here with us. The Democratic Party locally is really fired up and excited. We're kicking off our GOTV efforts this evening during the debate, and so it's going to be really exciting to be watching that. I think Senator Harris, I'm expecting her to have a really strong performance tonight, and I think it's going to be a really good debate, particularly following the fiasco of last week, where we'll actually get to hear from these candidates on the issues that are important to voters. And I think having Salt Lake City as the backdrop, having a state and a city that is, you know, on the cusp of turning blue, or a county on the cusp of turning blue, that it's really, really exciting to have the attention here.
Yeah. Dan, I know that the Utah legislature has been supportive of having this debate here. Can you give the listeners some background on how that happens? I mean, we have the Utah Debate Commission that shows leadership here, but it is not easy to land something like this.
It's not. If you think of all the major cities in the United States of where a presidential debate can be and where, you know, where a forum can, you know, host those kinds of things, they're numerous. And these debates, you know, interestingly, everybody knows in the show, I like to read books about history, and these debates used to happen a lot more frequently. And they, you know, before TV, they would be regional debates all over the place. And that was kind of fun. Today, obviously, we can televise and do things differently, and candidates can focus on probably more productive activities than debates, because debates don't tend to change anyone's mind. But interestingly, you know, pulling together everybody to get a debate and getting it hosted at, you know, really one of our, and I'm going to say it, it's going to make me feel ill in my stomach, but one of our banner institutions in the state, the University of Utah. Anthony, please put down the U sign. But being able to showcase what we believe really is special about Utah. I'm grateful. It's been cool also with the COVID protocols. The vice president and Senator Kamala Harris had to come into town days earlier than they normally would. Usually they would arrive like an hour before the debate. They would touch down, they would debate, and then they would get back on an airplane and be gone, maybe have a fundraiser, that kind of thing, to support a local candidate, and they're gone. This time, though, they came into town and they have been disrupting traffic all over downtown. I've seen selfies with Senator Harris all over town. And so it's been super interesting to, you know, see more of that this time than there is in the past.
Emily, give us the background on what we saw with Kamala Harris going up to This Is the Place Monument. If I remember right, she had like on Converse gym shoes and a nice, you know, outfit, and she talked about the history of Salt Lake City. She talked about Brigham Young, and she even quoted a famous sort of Mormon hymn or phrase, putting your shoulder to the wheel. Did you or the party have anything to do with all of that setup? She also has an incredible op-ed in the Deseret News appealing to, I'll call it the vote of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Yeah, I think that the Biden-Harris campaign has they're really in touch with, you know, voters want a candidate. They want someone to represent them who is going to bring hope and optimism and who's going to speak their language. And I think that she's come prepared to do that. I think going up to This Is the Place, I think she was up there with former Senator Scott Howell. So she's obviously connected in with the Democratic Party's infrastructure here in Utah. And so I think it's really, really telling that they see messaging to Utah voters, Democratic voters, and independents and moderates as something that's really important. I mean, Utah is not usually a state that gets a lot of attention from national level politicians. And I think that having the debate in Salt Lake City has brought a little more attention there. But two, the fact that she has taken steps to really get to know the culture here and get to know how to really talk to Utahns, I think is really telling of just the level of attention that they're paying to every single voter in this race.
Yeah, interesting. Dan, I would love to hear your prediction. Now, keep in mind, of course, the debate will have occurred, but what are you looking for tonight? What do you want to see? And then our listeners can just assess whether you got your wish or not. And Emily, I'll ask you the same question.
Well, this will be a very different debate than we saw, obviously, from the presidential candidates. Some felt like that was more of a street fight than it was anything else. And honestly, I love when, I've since had a chance to reflect really on the debate from last time and have changed my feelings, but we won't revisit that. I'll just say it was definitely a street fight. That said, this debate, former governor Pence, and now Vice President Pence is a much more stately figure and a little bit more of a traditional political person. And I think it will be less of a ballroom brawl and more of a discussion about policy and ideas, I hope. I think this will also be a launching point, really, for the vice president in 4 years, because I think a lot of people are going to see that he is a very competent leader and is able to really, work to get the people's support. And I think he adds a lot of credibility to the Trump ticket. And so I think this will be a great debate. I really do. I think I'm really interested, honestly, to see the interplay between the two candidates. I think I like them both as people. I think they're going to be very good on the stage.
Emily, what are you hoping to see? And as I toss it over to you, I'll say, in my point of view from the middle, I want to see likable candidates. I want to see candidates that appeal to me, because I find the current theatrics of the person in the White House so unfortunate, and so divisive. And so I won't say that I've met Vice President Pence, but I've been in a room with him in a setting, a small setting where he, had his wife and his daughters with him. And I saw how he filled the room and I listened to his commentary. Mm-hmm. And he is a very skilled orator, in my opinion. Emily?
Yeah, I think I kind of agree with Dan. I think that I'm expecting to see a much more substantive discussion of issues that are important to voters on both sides. And it's not going to be, a situation where one of the candidates is not following the agreed to setup of the debate. So we're actually going to be able to hear what they think and hear a back and forth of, what do these parties believe? And I think, I think Harris is going to have a strong showing of the strength of the Democratic platform. And I think Pence is really going to be seeking to add credibility to the ticket. Unfortunately, I think that at the end of the day, fortunately for us, voters are going to look at that and they're going to say, okay, well, Pence has a good showing, but Trump is still the top of this ticket and he is still a chaotic force in the White House, which has just been exacerbated over the last week with all of the COVID news that's been coming out. And so I think that, as much as Vice President Pence is going to be trying to add credibility, I don't think it's going to work in the end.
Yeah. Let's spend the last minute just talking about what the current polls show in the presidential race. If I have it right, this is Y2 Analytics polling 1,200 likely voters. They did this between late September and early October. a margin of error of, you know, plus or minus 2.8 percentage points. But they have, if I have my numbers right, do correct me if I'm wrong, but they have Donald Trump with a 10 percentage point lead in Utah. Dan, you think that's going to hold?
Oh, it'll be more. I'm predicting it'll probably be around 15 to 20% is my guess is where the president wins Utah.
Wow. Emily, your prediction?
You know, I think that that will probably widen once we get to Election Day. But I think that even if it's a, you know, a more of like a 15% lead, that's still a big gain for Democrats in the state over previous elections.
I'm going to be different than my other two hosts. I think it will tighten a little bit. I just have confidence in the Utah voter that they will see the need for a change of direction for this country.
Yes,
so,
it's
going to be interesting to see.
I think we're going to see a big swing from women towards Biden this election.
Some of that. Dan, you got to deal with the women. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Natalie Gochner from the Political Center, Emily Hayes on the left, Dan McKay on the right. Stay tuned for our second segment.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Emily Hayes on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I want to talk about the drama, you two, that's been happening in Washington, D.C. I follow Spence Checkets on Twitter. He's a local sports radio guy. But he basically tweeted, you elect a reality TV star, you get a reality TV star. And this has been made for television. Trump tests positive. Trump gets a Marine One helicopter ride to Walter Reed Hospital. Trump gets in a Suburban and goes and waves at his supporters all masked up. Trump returns to the White House. Trump goes up on the porch and removes his mask. It is beyond belief in some ways, right? That the notion that truth is stranger than fiction. Dan, let's go to you first. But what a week in American politics and political drama.
Well, and you add to that, right? They are tracing the source of a lot of this corona outbreak to a meeting in, Rose Garden gathering, and tracing it back to the White House and a function. I mean, the president's usually insulated from stuff like this, and it's just, this is, I think for a lot of people that came home quickly. It was interesting. You could hear people predicting two things with this president. One, they would predict that when he got the virus and when that announcement was made, some were saying, hey, he's finally going to take it serious. And then some were saying, well, if he isn't impacted that much, then he's going to be dismissive and that kind of thing. It's clear, though, that the president has decided to take option two, which is, hey, his tweet was, hey, the coronavirus really isn't that bad. Don't let it set your life aside. Let's move on. You know what I mean? Which was super interesting. And then there's everybody making all these issues about the president not wearing a mask.
Discouraging for the, 200,000 plus Americans who have died.
No question. I'm not saying, well, it wasn't discouraging for them. They've passed on, but for their family members, I'm certain it was very, tough to hear the president saying, things like that. That said,
it's not that the people that died were weak. It's that, they were unlucky.
No, I take nothing away from that. I just think it's interesting that, of the two predictions, most people called it that the president would kind of downplay it. And I do think the president, in a lot of ways, is trying to restore or get us back to some kind of normalcy, right? We can't continue to have a viable economy, all the other trade-offs by continuing, some of the measures that are being requested by the Democrats and others. So the president is trying to obviously posture that way. I still wish that there was a component of, hey, it's not a big deal, but social distance. Hey, it's not a big deal, but and go, wear a mask or do those kinds of things. I wish he would include those public health components, but that just isn't President Trump.
We'll go to you, Emily. But Dan, you can't, you know, say it's not a big deal, but that's nobody's going to do it.
I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm just saying that's the path, right? And that's what the president's doing.
I mean,
I would take a different tack to all of this.
I thought there was a chance here for a reset, but we're not getting it, Emily.
Yeah, I totally agree. I definitely had the feeling that, you know, the latter of those options was what was going to happen as well, that, you know, it wouldn't affect him too much. And frankly, he's still not out of the woods. I mean, many people have talked about their experiences with COVID and, you know, feeling, you know, bad at first, getting a little bit better, and then it really hitting them about a week into experiencing symptoms. So I, you know, unfortunately, I think it's very likely that we still see the president experience issues from this. So for him to kind of declare victory and have his mission accomplished moment, I think is premature. I also think it's really, really disappointing that he is downplaying the severity of this virus. I mean, in all reality, we are 6 to 8 weeks to getting this under control at any point if we choose to do the things required to make that happen. Most other Western countries and Asian countries have done this. They have implemented rapid testing. They've implemented masks, social distancing, work from home requirements. And if the president isn't even willing to implement these risk controls within his own administration, how are we to expect him to lead us out of this when, you know, this virus is not going away? We're not getting a magical vaccine that's going to magically appear on November 1st, like he keeps saying. And it's going to take things like individual actions. And I think it is the role of the government to tell people what to do. We do it on all sorts of safety issues. We're told to wear seatbelts. We're told to brush our teeth. And I think wearing a mask, social distancing, not going to large gatherings, these are things that we can be doing to help each other. And I think each of us also has people in our lives who would be very, very adversely affected from this. I have family members who have, you know, severe pulmonary diseases that they live with every day, and getting COVID would pretty much be the end for them. And so watching our president just undermine this and make it seem like it's not a big deal, I mean, it's dangerous to public health. And now he's endangering us on a national security basis because our Joint Chiefs of Staff are quarantining. I haven't heard if they've tested positive or negative yet. I know that was just kind of released yesterday afternoon that they, I believe it was a vice something of the Coast Guard had tested positive. And so they were all in a meeting, so they all had to quarantine. But now, like, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff not being able to meet together, what does that mean for national security? And what else is this going to affect with our abilities to, you know, run the White House and run our national security apparatus? So, you know, everyone's overwhelmed by Twitter these days, just watching all of these new cases fall out. They won't even allow the CDC to trace what happened at this Rose Garden event. And he expects to be the person that's going to lead us out of this. I think that that's I don't think voters are buying that. And it's a really, really sad week for the American people.
Hey, everybody wants to make a big look. I get it. And the Democrats want to cast aspersions on President Trump. I will just highlight that during the last pandemic in 1918, the president at that time, Woodrow Wilson, did the same exact thing with the Spanish flu and said, this isn't a big deal. We need to get life back to normal. We need to do X, Y, and Z and move things on. And I will just say, it is not uncommon for the presidents of the United States to look at a pandemic differently than members of their opposite party might look at it. It's really too bad, honestly, that Americans for some reason, it is just our culture, we just rebuff the idea of taking aggressive measures ourselves and, you know, fight back against government telling us what to do. It's just, I heard another commentator call it this last week. It's just in our nature. We won't be told what to do.
So as a result,
we're going to suffer, I think.
Calling out incompetence is not a partisan issue. And just because people disagreed with Woodrow Wilson doesn't give Trump some sort of cover. He has not been following health experts from the beginning. And I think that that's what people want. They don't want the response to this pandemic to be a partisan issue. And Trump has made it a partisan issue because from day one, it has been about him trying to position himself to.
That is not true, Emily.
How is that not
get
true,
off of
Dan?
Twitter.
He has obfuscated the truth. He has talked about Democratic governors and not wanting to help them because they are Democratic governors. He's made it partisan from day one, and to deny that is simply ingenuine. And I think you know that.
Dan and Emily, I'm clearly in the political middle here, and I mean, I'm legitimately so, but I just have to throw out there that I'm not so worried about what government does in terms of mandates, executive orders, all those sorts of things. I know from the data that it's all about public confidence and how the public feels. And we have considerable evidence, Dan, to your point, that this economy is not going to do well as long as this virus is in the wild. And so you can't ignore it and have the economy recover.
Well, and you also can't prioritize it, make it every news story and make it every partisan issue you can't do all of those things either and expect confidence to return.
And this is my point why I'm in the political middle, because I do not agree with Donald Trump's, behavior here, because I believe that leadership matters and a public message matters and your example matters, because what we're trying to do is change human behavior. And that happens through leadership, not through mandates. So, okay, I want to jump to another topic. I want to talk about the stimulus.
I disagree. It doesn't happen through leadership, Natalie. What happens is personal impact. People being aware of something and it changing something in their lives, that's what changes human behavior. I've rarely seen a leader stand up and actually change personal behavior that wasn't already going that direction. Sorry, that's just me.
That's all right. Let's jump through a couple of quick issues. The stimulus bills, looks like we're not going to get a stimulus pre-election. A lot of political commentators were really shocked at this because it helps these candidates, no matter who they are on both sides of the aisle, get elected if they get a bill passed. Emily, what do you make of that?
It's mind-boggling to me. I don't understand why the Senate won't consider a bill and why Donald Trump doesn't want to provide stimulus before this election. The Democrats are pushing for this because people are hurting, states are hurting, small businesses are hurting. And without this help, we are going to see our economy continue to hurt from this pandemic. And, you know, it seemed like discussions were going pretty well between Nancy Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin. And then as soon as Trump got back from Walter Reed, everything collapsed. And it was clear from the market reaction yesterday that Trump seems to now this morning be seeing that what his decision was not probably the best thing for the economy. And he's kind of backtracked. But I just don't know what he's doing from a negotiation standpoint at this point.
Dan, I'll give it an idea. If I understand it right, the Democrats are at about $2.2 trillion. The Republicans are at about $1 trillion. Let's just do a $1.5 trillion stimulus and help people in need.
And that's what the president has asked for. And disappointingly, the Democrats can't even find compromise there. They want to spend all or nothing. And that's really what they've told the president. That's why the president's just said, we're going to stop negotiating. But if you look at it, the House of Representatives came up with a budget bill that totally, like, you know, I could go through some of those things, but like bailing out the post office. Okay, dealing with that. They had bailout states for state with pension problems and those kinds of things that Utah has already dealt with ourselves, right? But they also restore the SALT deduction for income tax, which at the end of the day would only benefit the high tax liberal states. It will do nothing for Utah. And so you go through some of the poison pills that are in that bill. There are significant poison pills that do nothing for Utah. And that's why, surprisingly, even Ben McAdams couldn't support the bill. Democrat Ben McAdams thought it was a terrible bill. And so you're right, Natalie. The president's right. We should have passed a much smaller measure that was focused on dealing with the actual issues instead of the Democratic pork project. But by all means, let's turn over the whole government to the Democrats so they can just pork this thing all the way out. It'd be great.
Hey, Dan, what do you make of Mayor Mendenhall requesting a move of Salt Lake City from yellow to orange amid this surge? She said, our data is continuing upward trend is alarming and swift action is necessary. You think the state will grant that?
Here's what I think. I think the state should. But here's what I think should happen. Mayor Mendenhall is setting the right example, in my opinion. She is showing that local leadership matters much more than even a county leadership or a county led effort, or even worse, a state-led effort, and worse, a federal government-led effort about how it should be. That's what we should all be grateful for about President Trump being in charge right now, and is the fact that the federal government is out of it from a local control measure. And that's the one thing we are proving, and is the one problem we have in Utah by letting the governor continue to run this thing by emergency fiat.
Emily, we'll give you the last word. We've got 30 seconds in the program.
Yeah, I'll disagree with that. I think that without leadership from the top and coordination, it really affects the ability for local leaders to get this under control. People who live in Salt Lake City don't stay in Salt Lake City all of the time, and people who live outside of Salt Lake City travel into the city constantly. So having, some sort of framework that can really lead behavior on a wider basis, I think, is really important. And then local municipalities can set stricter restrictions if they want to, but that lack of leadership is really hurting us.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I've been with Emily Hayes and Dan McCam, Natalie Gochner. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.